You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 14th of February 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, it's Italy's oldest bank and it could be the country's biggest scandal. The journalist who has delved deepest into the controversy at the Monte dei Paschi explains why it could be even worse than many have feared.
We've seen revelations over the last few weeks about derivatives use that was completely unknown about until recently, and therefore we've discovered that the situation of the bank is in a weaker capital position than had even estimated.
Time Warner is getting rid of all the magazines you've never heard of. What will it mean for those that remain? Time, Fortune and Sports Illustrated. We're in New York for the latest. Two transport stories, one you'd expect and one you wouldn't. Our transport editor brings us the latest on the American Airlines-US Airways merger, while in Finland we'll have a man on a bike in the snow. We're at the International Winter Cycling Congress. And finally, our Madrid correspondent has a new gig.
Yo os quiero presentar a otro de los colaboradores del Intermedio International Edition, y que se llama Liam Aldous.
Liam Aldous has inexplicably become a TV star in Spain. We'll find out why and how. All that plus we play some music too, all to come in the next hour here on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. But before any of that, here's James Luckhurst with the news from around the world.
Monocle 24 News. The South African athlete Oscar Pistorius has been charged with murdering his girlfriend at his home in Pretoria. Pistorius, a double amputee who became one of the biggest names in world athletics, will appear in court on Friday. Police said Pistorius and his girlfriend, model Reva Steenkamp, had been the only people in the house at the time of the shooting. Former teacher Selma Lawrence shared her memories of Reva, the schoolgirl.
I knew Reva for 5 years. She was at our school for 5 years. I taught her maths for about two of those years. So I knew her quite well. She was a humble person. She was beautiful inside and out. She was very intelligent. She did extremely well academically. And she was popular amongst her peers. And I just knew that she would be successful in whatever she would do one day because of her intelligence and her personality and her looks. She had it all.
Britain's Food Standards Agency says six horses slaughtered in the UK that tested positive for the drug phenylbutazone were exported to France and may have entered the human food chain. The FSA says it's gathering information on the six carcasses sent to France and will work with the French authorities to trace them. In other developments, horse meat has been detected in frozen lasagna on sale in Germany, and supermarkets have started removing the product from their shelves. South Korea has sent a stern warning to North Korea 2 days after the North tested a nuclear bomb, saying it could strike the isolated state if it believed an attack was imminent. North Korea conducted its third nuclear test on Tuesday in defiance of UN resolutions. Pyongyang said that the test was designed to bolster its defenses due to the hostility of the United States, which has led a push to impose sanctions on the country after its long-range missile launch. North Korea on Thursday repeated its warning that any further sanctions would provoke it into taking firmer action. American Airlines and US Airways have confirmed that they're to merge in an $11 billion deal to create the world's biggest airline. But business travel groups have warned that the merger is likely to result in higher fares and cuts in flights to some destinations. The boards of the two carriers finally agreed to the merger following meetings in the US on Wednesday night. US Air's management team, led by Chief Executive Doug Parker, will assume operational control of the airline. Kenyan presidential candidate Uhuru Kenyatta has asked for his trial on crimes against humanity charges to be delayed to allow time to prepare for his defence. The request follows a late disclosure of evidence by prosecutors, according to his lawyers. Mr. Kenyatta, a former finance minister, is accused at the International Criminal Court of orchestrating clashes in which 1,200 people died and thousands were uprooted from their homes after disputed elections in December 2007. His defense lawyer, Stephen Kay, asked for the chance to prove that the prosecution had been lying.
Let us investigate these allegations properly, and we will show you we are right again. But what is happening here is that we are being denied that opportunity.
Pope Benedict has indicated he'll withdraw into isolation away from public sight after his resignation at the end of the month. In his capacity as Bishop of Rome, he told a group of priests from the diocese, "Even if I'm withdrawing into prayer, I will always be close to all of you, and I'm sure you will be close to me." Those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
James, thank you very much indeed. It is 22.05 in Dubai, 18.05 here in London, 13.05 in New York City. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. At 19.22 in Milan, 18.22 here in London. You're listening to Midori House. Italy is a country that has had more than its fair share of scandals. In the 1990s, it was the scene of Europe's biggest political corruption imbroglio, while a decade ago, the continent's biggest bankruptcy, that of the dairy company Parmalat, was also made in Italy. And of course, they have a chap called Silvio Berlusconi, who used to be Prime Minister. Now it's doing its best to win a prize for Europe's biggest banking scandal. The controversy surrounding the world's oldest bank, the Monte dei Paschi, is threatening to engulf large swathes of the political and economic elite. Rachel Sanderson is the Milan correspondent for the Financial Times and has been following this story since the start. She joins me now. Rachel, welcome to Midori House. I mean, this began with a secret bailout and the revelation of that. And since then, it's really snowballed, hasn't it?
Yes, it has. It's become a huge story in Italy, right in the middle of a sort of seismic election campaign, which we're going to see the country going to the polls at the end of next week. And we've got revelations almost rolling day by day. Just today, the head of the finance department at Monte dei Paschi, or the former head of the finance department at Monte dei Paschi, was arrested. So you can see where we're going.
Indeed. Well, I mean, what is it that marks this out from the other, big banking scandals that we've seen over the last few years? Because, I mean, it's very easy for a lot of us to roll our eyes and think, bloody, another bank is with another scandal. What is it that marks this one out as being particularly dangerous?
I think partly it's because of the picaresque angle, the fact that we do have a bank that considers itself the world's oldest. It's 541 years old. It was initially created in order to lend money to pilgrims on their way to Rome who were coming through Siena. So you've got that angle, which makes it fascinating. On the other side, it's because it is a bank that is very much tied up and has been for hundreds of years with various elites in Italy, most recently with the Democratic Party in Italy, who were leading quite substantially in the polls until this scandal broke. And now their lead over, you mentioned Silvio Berlusconi, but Silvio Berlusconi's centre-right coalition is now down to about 5 or 6 points when they were previously up sort of 20 points ahead.
When we look at other banking scandals, certainly here in the UK, we had RBS, which really all started to fall apart after they made a huge billion-dollar acquisition of another bank, a multi-billion-dollar acquisition of another bank, which was perhaps too much for them to take on. Do the roots of the downfall of Monte dei Paschi begin in a similar sort of way?
Absolutely. This is a sort of fascinating angle about this. You could call, Monte dei Paschi the third curse of ABN AMRO, because, of course, the unwinding of the Royal Bank of Scotland came from its purchase of a swathe of ABN AMRO, Fortis in Belgium, which bought another part of ABN AMRO as it was being broken up, also ended up itself being broken up, partly taken over by the state. And now you've got Monte dei Paschi, and Monte dei Paschi's difficulties started when it bought, as it were, the third part of the breakup of ABN AMRO, which was an Italian regional bank called Anton Veneta. And like RBS and like Fortis, it paid an extremely high price for its bit of Anton Veneta, for its bit of the broken up of ABN AMRO. And since then, it was never been able to recover.
Now, you mentioned there's already been arrests in this case. Is there the suspicion that there was actually quite serious criminal activity here? This isn't just banks that got a little bit eager and thought that they could do more than they could.
I can repeat to you what I've heard from prosecutors, and of course, so these are allegations that are coming out of prosecutors in Siena. There are a couple of other cities that are also running investigations. Rome is another one, and Trani down in the south, where they've got a very eager prosecutor, is also looking into what happened at Monte de' Paschi. One of the lines of pursuit, let's put it that way, by the prosecutors is that certain members of the sort of top finance committee at Monte de' Paschi were, as it were, creaming off kind of 5% of deals that they were making. Now, that's one line of pursuit by the prosecutors. Those are allegations that they're making. We've had nothing confirmed along those lines, and those involved are saying that they did nothing wrong. The other question is the fact that there were derivatives that were hidden. I've spoken to people who've seen those term sheets, and apparently there were derivatives which were absolutely intended to hide losses specifically, and this is something that prosecutors are also investigating. So if these allegations are true, these are quite serious corporate crimes.
Rachel Sanderson in Milan, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Midori House. When Japan's defense minister outlined his plan to develop preeminent strike capability in times of national danger, it was the latest in the nation's journey from pacifism to a more traditional defense policy. Itsunori Onodera has declared in no uncertain terms that if the threat is imminent, Japan is allowed under the law to carry out strikes against enemy targets. He's probably talking about North Korea, though I'm sure he wouldn't mind if China heard him too. Our news editor Tom Edwards spoke to our Asia editor-at-large, Kenji Hall, and asked whether we should be surprised by this move.
I think it's not surprising at all. I think this is a direct reaction to North Korea's test firing of a nuclear device earlier this week. It's basically, I think you can interpret it as Japanese officials publicly saying that they have an option, that its rhetoric is a form of deterrence, really. The thing that's different this time is that, first of all, the defense minister, Itsunori Onodera, in this interview with Reuters, didn't actually specifically use the words preemptive strike. But what he said essentially did suggest that. I think Japan is very careful about what it says whenever it talks about defense. The biggest worry is that China, South Korea, and North Korea in particular, will sort of get scared about a rearmed Japan. This is, you know, harks back to Japan's history in the early 20th century, essentially invaded countries throughout the region and did so brutally. But this time, it's also sort of couched what it said in terms of joint defense, U.S.-Japan security alliance. It also normally talks about defense in terms of things like the PAC-3 missiles that it has stationed around Japan, or on battleships that are equipped with Aegis radar tracking systems. But, you know, Japan's military, it's called the Self-Defense Force, it's really a defense force in name only. If F-15 fighter jets and the F-35 stealth fighter jets that it plans to buy are sort of defensive in nature, then, I mean, I think, you know, we're all fooling ourselves into thinking that Japan's military is completely defensive.
Well, I want to ask you about that. I mean, what is the kind of legal standing then? There's obviously this kind of commitment to pacifism broadly in terms of a diplomacy that's very peace-oriented. What's the legal structure there? I mean, there's facility then, presumably, to amend that self-defense-only sort of policy? Or how does it actually work?
Right. So Japan's post-World War II constitution has an article. It's Article 9. And this, in this article, it's very specific. It renounces the right for Japan to use military force to settle disputes. That has always kept a lid on any sort of aspirations Japan might have in rearming to the point where it doesn't need the U.S. as sort of a military crutch. At the same time, you know, because of the tensions, because of North Korea in particular, Japan has boosted. It has one of the world's largest defense budgets. It has battleships, it has fighter jets, it has missiles. You know, so it's essentially, it's saying we're not going to use these to attack another country, but we will use it to defend ourselves. In this case, The defense minister is sort of splitting hairs. He's saying if we are being attacked, we will use them.
And then in terms of the relationship with China, do you think, I mean, there's obviously these oft-described plans to set up some kind of, I believe, Onodera said, a maritime communication mechanism. Do you think there's any scope for that? And then for any broader diplomatic ties, for example, could we even see Japan and China trying to come together in terms of maybe imposing sanctions on North Korea? Could that actually happen?
That's a good question. I don't know if you would ever see Japan and China agreeing on specific sanctions against North Korea. I mean, you might see it in the context of the United Nations, where China has actually supported a tightening of sanctions against North Korea before North Korea's third test detonation of a nuclear device. You asked about the hotline. This is something that Japan and China have been discussing for years, actually, and they broke off negotiations a couple of years ago. That is something that Tokyo wants to continue. The problem is, of course, that you need two sides to discuss this, and at this point, China doesn't seem to be all that eager to do so. If you look at the other countries in the region, China has a hotline with Korea, Japan has a hotline with Korea, the U.S. has hotlines with all three countries. The only sort of disconnect is between Japan and China, and so a lot of experts are saying, well, if there was this hotline, the two countries would be able to sort of settle things directly without having to go through the media, which they do now.
And Kenji, just finally and briefly, obviously we've discussed there Japan actually very well armed, you know, the Navy, the military forces are actually very well equipped. Aside from engaging in a kind of an arms race as North Korea boosts its military capability, what other options do you think are available to Japan then? Is there any other things, perhaps diplomatically, that they can do instead of just trying to, you know, arm up more heavily?
Well, I think in many ways, Japan errs on the side of sort of safety. I mean, they haven't been known to posture in the way that you see some of the other countries in the region doing. They tend to, for instance, you mentioned that last week a Chinese frigate had locked its targeting radar on a Japanese destroyer. This is something that Japan brought up directly with China. China has denied it. Japan says it has irrefutable evidence. I don't think you're going to see Japan sort of stepping up the aggression. Japan always tends to take these things very sort of literally and legally. And I think Article 9 in the Constitution is one of the reasons, one of the things that sort of keeps it from actually acting out.
That was our Asia Editor-at-Large, Kenji Hall, speaking with Tom Edwards. Stay with us right after this. We're in New York talking about time, not that sort of time, time.
We love to champion retailers who make a point of differentiating themselves from other offerings on the high street. Our latest Monocle Briefing film travels to Buenos Aires, New York, and Budapest to visit specialist shops where making is at the heart of their retail offering.
One of the big challenges with any denim brand, or any brand for that matter, is to really try and explain to the customer why it's special, why it's unique, and why it's worth investing, you know, a lot of money in a great product.
You can view handmade retailers and over 300 more films and slideshows on monocle.com.
Section D is Monocle 24's show about design. Each week we take you on a whistle-stop tour of the people and places making a splash in the world of craft, architecture, graphics, fashion and retail.
How do you explain the value of design? What can we do to make clients and designers work better together?
On the latest episode, we head to Stockholm for the 62nd Annual Furniture Fair. There's plenty more besides furniture, though. We also talk lighting, flooring, food, fiddly locks and fancy paints, too.
Been working with the lock, trying to enhance the experience of opening the door, trying to stop and give a thought to what you're actually doing.
That's Section D with Hugo MacDonald, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
And you're back with Midori House, 1814 here in London, 1314 in New York City. Time Warner was built on print. the home to Time, of course, Fortune, Sports Illustrated, People, InStyle, and dozens of other titles, it has, for decades, been one of the magazine industry's leading players. But times are tough, particularly for conglomerates that have perhaps lost touch with the art of magazine making. Time Warner is now in talks to sell off most of its stable, keeping only its biggest names, Time being one of those. Edmund Lee is a media reporter for Bloomberg News, and he joins me now. Edmund, when we look at what Time is selling off, it may be the names that we don't that aren't quite as familiar to us, but it's pretty much the bulk of what they do, isn't it, when it comes to magazines?
Yeah, it's almost their entire stable. And, the thing to note is that the deal would probably take away most of Time Inc.'s women-focused titles. So like People and InStyle, Real Simple, these are titles that are popular here that tend to be geared towards women. And the deal that it's being discussed is with another magazine company, Meredith, which is almost entirely a women-focused publisher. So that's the reason why I think also holding on to Time magazine itself, it was the foundation of the company way back when, and it's the nameplate is on the top of the company. So there are maybe some sentimental and even some marketing reasons for that. But the real reason, frankly, is that Meredith wasn't so interested in the newsweeklies and the more male-focused titles.
It wanted the ones that perhaps they could make some money with. Now, you mentioned the fact that, this possibility of sentimental reasons. Obviously, Time is in. It's on the nameplate. It's on the brass at the front. It's, it's on the masthead of everything. Companies don't necessarily keep things that are losing money for sentimental reasons, though, do they? And Time is not, it's certainly losing sales. It's down about 23% in 2012. It certainly doesn't look like it's rising anytime soon. Do you think they want to keep it just because the name's in the title, or do they have a plan to make it great once again?
No, it is a good point. Jeff Bukas, who is the CEO of Time Warner Inc., the big parent company that owns Time Inc., he's a hard-nosed executive. He's not given in to sentimentality about media properties the way that, say, Rupert Murdoch is about his media properties. So, in all fairness, if he could have, he probably would have sold the entire lot. I think it was more the fact that the other partner in this new venture, Meredith, they just simply weren't interested in those titles, largely because they're money losing. They're very, very. It's a difficult market for print, especially for news weeklies. With the advent of the internet and Twitter and the web and everything, a news weekly just seems very, very out of date by the time people get to it. So, for all those reasons, there is a real business reason why that wasn't ported over to this new entity. Now, I think they'll hold on to it. They'll do the best they can with it. But should another buyer come along who wants just those bits, he could very well sell those as well.
I mean, you say it's difficult for news weeklies, and, to a certain extent, I would agree with that. And obviously, Newsweek has suffered to the extent that it's no longer a news weekly. It's merely a website. But you look at The Economist, and that's a news weekly, and their sales are up. You look here in the UK, The Spectator is a news weekly, and their sales are up. And I look at the Time Bureau here in London, and maybe a decade ago, we were looking at more than 50 members of staff there, whereas now we're looking at 3. Is part of the problem here that they're just not doing it very well?
No, I think that is a good point. I mean, The Economist is a news weekly that is doing better than ever, you could argue. I think at the same time, the formats are very different. I think Time was always a lighter read and would still have big in-depth features, certainly, but had sort of a different kind of news peg. They figured there's a lot of things happening in a given week. Let's sum it up. Now that summing up happens, every day on websites. So that weekly doesn't quite fit that format. The Economist, the example you bring up, which is a great example, I think is unique. It doesn't quite have it presents news in such a way that you really can't get elsewhere, that you're not even finding on the internet, despite sort of the explosion of media these days. So I think they've been better able to hold on to what they do best, and I think Time simply hasn't, because there are lots of websites, there's lots of other media out there that do the same thing, if not better, and maybe more tailored to very specific audiences. And I think Time was always about a mass audience, and I think that's becoming harder to hold on to as an enterprise.
If Jeff Bukas is looking to sell Time, and from what you said, it's quite possible that he'd rather be rid of it if he could. who is out there who would actually be interested in buying it? Because obviously Newsweek was sold once or twice, and that didn't really help it. Is there anyone out there who is looking at Time and think, you know what, that could be a good investment for me?
Well, you know what, I think there are definitely some companies out there, possibly even new media companies, that could look at, say, like a Time magazine and think, oh, that's still a great brand with, you know, a loyal readership still, even though it's a dwindling readership. They could definitely do something with that and see some upside to taking that brand and maybe just doing a better job online. So that is always that possibility. And then there's always Rupert Murdoch.
Well, yes, there is always Rupert Murdoch. I mean, you mentioned Murdoch, and obviously, you know, he's possibly looking at the Tribune Group at the moment. But I mean, if we were to look at, you know, the new media companies, I mean, are we looking at, say, you know, Politico? Would they think, okay, this is the sort of thing that we could perhaps buy, you know, not that not too high a price, and that could give us a bit more cachet?
You know, that is certainly a possibility. There are sort of emerging blogs and political news blogs out there that have a pretty, you know, they're doing a decent job, but they're still a very sort of small margin business in a lot of ways. Yeah, getting something like Time could certainly help them out. There's also the possibility of, like, a Huffington Post, for example, wanting to do a tie-up with a major legacy brand like Time, since they sort of both fit in the same space of all kinds of news everywhere that affect, you know, whether it's from Washington, D.C. to Hollywood, they both sort of kind of hit that general news reader. And I think, you know, there are always those possibilities, but those would still be big, big bets. And I think part of what's hard about sort of a smaller new media company going in and snapping up Time is still a pretty big, you know, revenue-generating magazine. The margins aren't great. It's actually losing money now. But I think, you know, it's just figuring out the mechanics of doing that is going to be the bigger issue versus, you know, does it fit from a content or from a brand standpoint? But again, it really comes down to political will. Like, you'd really, really want to have to do it. You'd have to be willing to take losses up front. And there, like I said, there are only so many people who can stomach that. And it typically comes down to Rupert Murdoch. He's one of the few out there who's willing to make big bets on traditional media. Magazines really haven't been his thing. He's always been a newspaper man.
No.
But you never know. I mean, he can look at it. Yeah, exactly.
You never know, indeed. Edmund Lee, a media reporter for Bloomberg News, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Midori House. You're listening to Midori House. In the next half hour of the programme, we'll discuss the consequences of the merger between US Airways and American Airlines. And as if one transport story wasn't enough, we'll also be cycling in the snow in Finland. But first, here's James Luckhurst with the headlines.
The South African athlete Oscar Pistorius has been charged with murdering his girlfriend at his home in Pretoria. Pistorius, a double amputee who became one of the biggest names in world athletics, will appear in court on Friday. Britain's Food Standards Agency says six horses slaughtered in the UK that tested positive for the drug phenylbutazone were exported to France and may have entered the human food chain. The FSA says it's gathering information on the six carcasses sent to France and will work with the French authorities to trace them. South Korea has sent a stern warning to North Korea 2 days after the North tested a nuclear bomb, saying it could strike the isolated state if it believed an attack was imminent. North Korea conducted its third nuclear test on Tuesday in defiance of UN resolutions. American Airlines and US Airways have confirmed they're to merge in an $11 billion deal to create the world's biggest airline. But business travel groups have warned that the merger is likely to result in higher fares and cuts in flights to some destinations. Kenyan presidential candidate Uhuru Kenyatta has asked for his trial on crimes against humanity charges to be delayed to allow time to prepare his defence. The request follows a late disclosure of evidence by prosecutors. Those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
James, thank you very much indeed. Now, as you just heard there, two US airlines, US Airways and American Airlines, have announced that they are to merge. The merger, said to make the biggest airline in the world, will bring the number of major American international carriers down to three. Of course, this could mean a few things for the American air travel industry and, of course, for American Airlines, which is still in Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection. Here to talk about this is Tristan McAllister, Monocle's transport editor. Tristan, welcome to Midori House. I mean, as I say, there's now just three international US carriers, whereas 5 years ago there were six. Is this a good thing for the industry, or is it a good thing for passengers, or can it be both?
I think you... Steve, it's a bit of both. If we think about it in terms of what it means for passengers, it would seem that the consolidation would mean less competition. But really, in actuality, when you look at the consolidation for U.S. Airways and American Airlines, they really only overlap on 12 routes. So that's pretty minimal considering this is the biggest airline in the world. So as far as competition, as far as seeing routes getting cut to increase fares, I don't think that's going to be a huge factor here. And that's where a lot of people seem to be crying foul. And then on the other hand, I think for the airline, in terms of their Chapter 11 bankruptcy, this can only mean good things. It means a wider reach. It means more revenue to tap into in terms of U.S. Airways, which by the way, had a very productive restructuring and a merger with America West a few years ago. So I think things seem to be looking up for the airline, and I think in the end, it might bode well for consumers too.
Now, American Airlines has gone through the mill a little bit over the last couple of years. The Chapter 11 bankruptcy we mentioned, the restructuring as well. But does this suggest that it's coming out the other side? We certainly saw it rebrand as well last month. Do you get the impression that we're going to see a stronger American Airlines on the other side of this, which will be able to genuinely compete a bit better than it has been in the past?
I think, yes, you will, for sure. And I think initially you saw that the top brass at American Airlines were very opposed to this merger, and now it seems that they're more on board. Of course, they voted last night, or the board at least voted last night, and it seems too that the executives are on board, and they see this as forward motion for the airline. And I think that initially the idea of the rebrand and the idea of the restructuring meant that it could do it all on its own. And I think creditors and everyone else weighed in and said, hey, it's really time to think about positive ways to move forward. And the merger seemed to be the biggest target for everyone. Now we're seeing that happened. That said, it's far from over for American in terms of troubles. They are still in Chapter 11. They still have issues with the pilots unions, although most of the unions have made good with the with U.S. Airways executives. So at least favorable terms in those contracts. Everyone's come to the table and said it's time to move forward. But again, there will be growing pains associated with this, like there were growing pains with the Delta Northwest merger that happened a few years ago. And then, of course, just pretty much finalizing itself last year was the United Airlines Continental merger, which was a lot of headaches for the airline as it integrated ticketing systems and frequent flyer programs. And I think that's a big question for a lot of people here.
Now, a word about US Airways, a brand that will be no more. It's going the same way as Continental, as TWA, as Pan Am. How will we remember it?
That's an interesting question. As far as major carriers in the U.S. go, U.S. Airways, really, it wasn't a top three. It hasn't been. It's not necessarily one of the most iconic American airline brands. American Airlines is, not only in the U.S., but I think you could make the argument that it is probably one of the most iconic airline brands in the world. So U.S. Airways will fade into the background, much in the same way that those other carriers did, much in the same way Northwest Airlines did with Delta and those that you mentioned. And the stronger brand, the more recognizable one, the one that will definitely drive more sales and has a stronger reputation, American Airlines will continue.
No, indeed. And when we look at what happens next for American Airlines, once this merger goes through fully, internationally, what will it mean for it? Who is it going to be able to compete with now that it perhaps wasn't able to compete with in the previous few years?
I think this is one of those questions that plays into a few things. When you look at where it's aligned globally in terms of alliances, Oneworld is the current airline alliance that it's in. U.S. Airways is in the Star Alliance. My assumption would be, and I think I've seen nothing to discredit the idea that American will stay in one world. I think that is ultimately going to be a good move for them. They have strong alliances with airlines in the One World Alliance that have reached to Asia, that have reached to Europe. One of the weaknesses here, and many of the analysts say this, and it seems pretty obvious looking at a route map, is that one of the biggest growth markets in the world in terms of aviation is Asia, and American Airlines doesn't have much of a presence there. So those alliances with airlines like Cathay Pacific, like Malaysia, like Qantas, those are very important through the One World Alliance, and I think that's where you're going to see them. They're going to need to rely on those to sort of build the brand in those regions of the world, and then allow their own passengers, their loyalty program passengers, to fly on through those hubs in Asia. That's going to be really, really important, and I can't stress that enough, because most of the other majors here have a fairly strong presence in Asia.
And just finally, I mean, as we say, there were, American Airlines, as in the industry of airlines in America, have had a pretty rough time since 2001. And as we said, they've just in the last few years gone down from 6 major airlines to 3. Do you think that period of consolidation is now over, or is it possible there might be the odd merger still to come?
It's hard to say, although it's funny now that we seem to have 3 of the biggest airlines in the world here. And there are, of course, the smaller ones that, these 3 airlines will have 70% of the market here in the U.S. That's huge. When you look at the low-cost carriers and then other parts of the market, like Alaska Airlines, you have JetBlue, you have those players that sort of fill in the gaps. They have strong presence regionally in certain parts of the U.S. I think that as far as consolidation goes, you've seen what we will see in terms of the major consolidation goes. And right now, what you'll see airlines really focus on is streamlining, making sure that they get their budgets in order, making sure that they get their costs in line. And this really seemed to be the last step to do that for these carriers. Most of the others are doing relatively fine financially. So I think right now you'll see a little more stability. And ultimately, that is a signal that things are probably going to get better.
Tristan McAllister, Monocle's transport editor, speaking to us from our New York bureau. Thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Midori House. It's just come up to 18:38 here in London. We'll be right back after this with Cycling Out in the Cold.
If we use, dear listeners, the metaphor of Monocle 24 as an online radio amusement park, then Culture with me, Robert Bound, is the roller coaster.
We are finally on the train, on the sexy contemporary art train.
Scaling the heights of artistic endeavour to look out across a picturesque international landscape dotted with galleries, live music venues, outdoor screenings of wonderful movies being scrutinised and applauded by appreciative audiences. Marvel at the view. Strap yourself in. Scream, ladies and gentlemen, if you want to go faster. We're just one metaphor away from a meltdown. On the latest edition, we host country rock legend Steve Earle. Head to Berlin and Burma for art and books, and via Mark Wallinger's new works for the London Underground, check out the new music scene in Egypt.
That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House, 1940 in Helsinki, 1840 here in London. Cycling during the winter might not sound like the greatest of ideas, as if walking in the cold wind was not enough. But there are lots of people who disagree with this. Bicycle enthusiasts from all over the world have been meeting this week in Oulu, northern Finland, at the International Winter Cycling Congress. Now, we could have interviewed Anders Swanson in the conference centre itself. He would have been wrapped up nice and warm. But instead, we thought it might be better to speak to him while he's out on his bike in the snow. Anders, welcome to Midori House.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Now, set the scene for us. You're on your bike at the moment. Whereabouts are you?
I'm pretty much in downtown Oulu. People are starting their nights out.
What is it about cycling in the winter, in the dark, in the snow, in the ice that's appealing? Because I've got to say, to me, it sounds not ideal.
Well, I mean, you mentioned being wrapped up warm. I'm pretty warm right now. You get warmer as you go. There's so many things that are appealing about it, from the sights, the sounds, the lack of smells, everything that's good about winter anyway is almost better on a bike. I don't know. Everything's better on a bike.
I'll take your word for it. Now you're from Winnipeg in Canada, which is obviously pretty cold itself. talk to me about the bike that you ride there, because, I mean, if you're cycling through snow and ice, I mean, do you need specific tyres just in the same way that that cars there tend to need different tyres?
You know, it's funny. That's the first thing I realized about Oulu is that we tend to overthink things a little bit. It really just comes down to having a place that cares about it and does what you need to do. I've seen grandmothers on bikes. I've seen people with three or four people on a bike. I've seen kids in baby carriages. And it honestly, the bike really doesn't matter. It's not about the bike. You can ride pretty much anything. And I would suggest anybody to just try it and see how it is. It's not as bad as people think.
Not as bad as people think, indeed. Tell us about the International Winter Cycling Congress then. I mean, what have people been talking about over the last couple of days that sparked your interest?
Well, for me, it's just been staggering. You've got city after city after city, most of them Swedish, Finnish, Nordic countries, of course, that, well, it turns out seem to do just about everything better than we do, except maybe hockey. And it's just, you know, some of its technical details, the finer points of slush, sand, sandy slush, and then some of it's just sort of about how when a place takes it seriously, it's actually quite easy. So the conference is just kind of putting a point on this idea that you can cycle in the winter, and there are some really, really good examples of places that do.
When you've been talking about, you know, some of the problems that people have cycling in winter, or the sort of the perceived problems, let's talk about, in fact, the perceptions. What is it that people think are the main problems with cycling in winter that actually you can just rule out for us right now?
The perceived problems, I guess, are, one, that it's dangerous. The only thing, verifiably speaking, statistically speaking, if you look at it, is driving. In the transportation system, if by any sort of stretch of the imagination, that's really the only thing that's dangerous. And that's just because of the amount of weight you carry and the speeds you're going and the sort of natural sort of conflict that you're putting yourself into. I mean, in North America especially, I don't know. I don't actually really know what it's like in the UK, for example, but a lot of people die, something like 40,000, no, definitely 40,000 people a year die in the United States from car accidents. And, I mean, again, like, we're a country that plays hockey, so we know that even if you did fall on your bike, you're landing on snow and ice, and you just slide and you get back up. And we ought to know that. We ought to know that a bit better than we do, and I think we've sort of forgotten something, and that's that when you get on a bike, you're a kind of a human being, and you're really only taking responsibility for yourself. And at worst, you might hurt yourself, but 9 times out of 10, you don't, even if something does go bad. So all you got to do is plow, basically.
Plow.
It's really not complicated. I mean, of course, there was a lot more interesting things than that to discuss at the conference, but that's the main thing, and that's the main thing I see here in Oulu.
When you talk about, you know, the changes that you need to make, I mean, people, you know, I talked about tyres earlier and you're like, no, don't be ridiculous, you don't need new tyres. All you need to do is wrap up warm. Is essentially all you need here is sort of long johns and gloves and you're fine?
Yeah, absolutely. And even less than that, because you generate a little bit of heat biking. That's one of the sort of misnomers. You know, I want to see this conference in Winnipeg and I want to see it continue. And I think it's been really great. But the more I think about it, you really need if you want to have a conference, you need to have a conference on summer biking in places that are really hot, because you know what? You can always warm up, but it gets tough to cool down.
That's a good point. Anders Swanson from Winnipeg, currently cycling in Oulu, Finland. And thank you also for being willing to do this interview while on a bike. That is where he was. Let me just make that clear. Thank you very much indeed. 1846 here in London. And to continue with the theme, here is Memory Tapes with Bicycle. Uh, That was Bicycle by Memory Tapes, 1849, here in London, 1349 in New York City. You're listening to Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. Now here at Monocle, we encourage our correspondents to, you know, occasionally spread their wings and take on the odd extra piece of work. Some people write books, some write for other publications. Our Madrid correspondent, Liam Aldous, has taken a different route. He's just made his debut performance on a new TV show in Spain, El Intermedio. Let's take a listen.
Debajo del titular aparece esto. El aceite extraído de la ballena, supuestamente medicinal, ya está a la venta en Portvila. Y al lado, el precio de la botella. Y ahora vamos a ver la foto del reportaje. Esta. Mira, el jefe Masamantonga.
Now, the show, Liam insists, is a Spanish version of The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, although we'll see whether it's really as funny as that. And young Mr. Aldous is going to be their Oceania correspondent for the international edition, bringing a slice of Sydney and beyond. Liam joins me now. Liam, I guess the first thing I should say is congratulations.
Well, thank you. I'm not in trouble, am I? It sounds like I'm in trouble for going on TV.
No. Far from it. We were all gathered around our laptops, watching eagerly yesterday to see how you were. And although I must say my Spanish isn't up to your high standards, you certainly seem to be you seem to be making a connection with the studio audience. Were they laughing with you or at you?
We're yet to see that. Hopefully, they laugh with me and at me. I think that's part of the kind of charm of the show, because I'm not the only foreigner, or the only Geary, as they call me, because any Anglo-Saxon is called a Geary in Spain, so I'm not the only foreigner. There's actually a Chinese guy as well, there's a Cuban girl, an African guy, and an Italian girl as well, so we're the foreign contingent of the show, so I think they'll be laughing at us, but I think we're going to show, we all speak Spanish really well, so I think we're going to show that foreigners are people too, which is something Spain needs to learn.
Excellent. Tell us a little bit about the show, and what sort of audience it gets, and what sort of type of person it is that watches it.
Well, lately, I mean, obviously everyone knows that the news in Spain is goes from bad to worse each day. So basically this show tells the news, their kind of catchphrase is, you heard the news today, now we're going to tell you the truth. That's how they start every show. And basically they tell the news, but with a bit of a comical edge, like the Daily Show, and they kind of put a positive spin on it, but they catch the politicians out doing the wrong thing, and they kind of compare stuff that politicians have said months earlier and kind of catch them out. So it's a bit of it is quite good journalism, but it's got a bit of comedy in there as well, because what Spain needs is a bit of comedy. And that, because of this, because they tell the news in a lighthearted way, their audience has been climbing rapidly over the last year. So they've decided to launch this international edition, which is what I'm part of. So the good thing, Steve, is that I won't be telling any jokes about the politicians and offending any potential interview candidates. So I'm only touching Australian news, and I won't be getting into trouble.
Excellent, good. Tell us about how this came up for you. How did you get this gig?
Well, it was actually a big series of coincidences, and it's actually been a little bit bittersweet, actually, because I had a trip planned to Australia, which I was meant to leave yesterday. I was going to go for about 6 or 7 weeks. I'm getting ahead of myself here. Basically,
you couldn't go to Australia because you've got to go on TV.
Yeah, I know. I had to choose. It's one of those big decisions in life. Do I go on TV or do I go back home? Maybe I'll go back home a hero if I go back home a little later. I'm not sure. But basically, I got the job just through someone. When I first moved to Spain, actually got a job working in a nightclub. And it was just another guy I worked with. He started working in a casting agency. And a year later, I was working as a journalist. And he said, oh, you're perfect for this role, and basically put me through the casting process, and it all kind of fell into place. But the only bad thing is the dates were probably the worst possible scenario for me. But I'm not going to complain.
Our hearts bleed. So tell us, you've done your first show. How did it go? Were you happy?
I was happy. It was basically, that was just a preview for the show that's going to air this weekend at 4 p.m. In Spanish time.
Oh, right.
Tomorrow, actually. We're recording the first shows tomorrow. It's going to be on Saturday and Sunday.
So it's going to be this weekend, the first show?
Yes. Well, I mean, I recorded a little segment that aired yesterday. Yeah, it was 24 hours ago.
Okay.
And that went quite well. It was actually live television, whereas the show we're doing will be pre-recorded, thank God. Live TV is a whole different ball game, like live radio, I guess.
Well, look, we're going to have to wrap up now, but why don't you, in Spanish, just give a little plug for your show to try and persuade our Spanish-speaking listeners to tune in on Sunday.
Okay, bueno, I'm going to say sorry to all the people who don't speak Spanish first, but...
That's all right, go on.
Para los que hablan español, hay que verlo este fin de porque que va a salir genial y a las 4 en la sexta y el sábado y domingo. Así que no echéis la siesta el sábado y domingo. And if you want me to translate what I just
no,
said...
No, Steve, that's quite all right.
Okay. I just want everyone not to have a siesta because it's the hour of the siesta. So
don't worry.
No one can have the siesta on the weekend.
We won't. Liam Aldous, our Madrid correspondent and now Spanish TV star. Thank you very much indeed. This is Midori House. And from one Australian to another, here's Adrian Craddock with his four rules of love.
I know what you're thinking. How obvious is it that I would do a monologue on Valentine's Day? I mean, I can already hear your shouts. Of course, Adrian Craddock, Monocle's resident man of love, would be rolled out to address us on this, the most romantic of days. I assure you, it's a coincidence of scheduling. Actually, now I think about it, being as I am, so hyper-aware of Cupid and his mysterious methods, perhaps it's not. You need me right now, and I'm happy to oblige. After all, if there's one thing I know, it's the babes. So I present to you Craddock's Four Rules of Love, Valentine's Day edition. Rule 1. Beware of grand romantic gestures. They can often set the bar of love too high. As a younger man, I once drove my now girlfriend up to the highest point of Perth. The cover story was that we were meeting friends, but when we got there, this master of love began to unravel his most cunning love plan. I kindly asked her to get something out of the trunk of my car while I pretended to rifle through my glove box. As she undid the latch, the A3 card with "Surprise Picnic" written in Sharpie pen calligraphy was exposed. Underneath the sign, a lobster sandwich. Much like a fantastic first date, the problem with all of this is that I've never again been able to recreate a gesture to this standard. Which leads me to Rule 2. Don't keep dining out on a romantic picnic that happened 5 years ago. In fact, take my advice. The babes need more romance than just one Valentine's Day a year. This is something that's been cleverly observed by the Taiwanese, who have not one, but two national days that celebrate love, first on February 14th and then July 7th. This confirms something I've always suspected. Forget the swooning French, the passionate Italians, and the fiery Spaniards. Surely it's the Taiwanese who are the true lovers. Love rule number 3. Don't talk about how consumerist Valentine's Day is. No matter how much your partner says they're not really into February 14th, they are. Everyone I've spoken to in the last few days has scoffed something about how they and their significant other are just staying in with a ready meal and some TV box set. But if that's true, why do the only roses left in London at the moment have fewer than 4 petals? Why are there only 10 p.m. bookings left for literally every restaurant that boasts a front door with a hinge? Don't get me wrong, it's something to be celebrated. In the US alone, Valentine's Day is expected to contribute $18.6 billion to the economy. That means a lot of jobs, and believe you me, the babes find employment pretty sexy. Final rule of love. When given any kind of public platform, always use it to name-check your loved one. I took this rule from the recent Grammys, where more time was spent celebrating wives and girlfriends than musical ability. So, to the girl who opened the trunk of my Kia Cerato, Karis, happy Valentine's Day. That's going to score me so many points. For Monocle, I'm Adrian Craddock.
And I really hope that's the last time the word babes is ever mentioned on Monocle 24. That's all we have time for on Midori House. Thanks to Marcus Hippie, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Barbara Feeney and Sam Impey. The news is next, and then you've got this week's episode of The Urbanist. The Daily is back at 2200 hours. Hugo will be here in this chair with Midori House same time tomorrow. For now, though, I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thanks very much for listening. Goodbye.